Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
Under the circumstances.
Understood. Well, welcome to the Marxist School of Sacramento. Tonight, we're very pleased to have as our speaker, Minchi Lee. He's an author, and he teaches economics at the University of Utah. Well, a bit like Malcolm X, Minchi used prison time to read widely. In fact, he studied radical political economy for 2 years when Chinese leaders locked him up for giving a critical public speech after the Tiananmen upsurge in 1989. Minchi's talk, The Rise of China and the Demise of the Capitalist World Economy, is from his book of the same title. I have read it and I recommend it to all concerned with the future, economically and ecologically. His book is available tonight. In brief, Minchi improves our understanding of the present era by unpacking the many consequences of China's transition to capitalism. One of the main implications he tackles is the rise of China and its impacts on the fragile dynamics of the existing world system. We're in for a pleasant talk and discussion tonight, so let us welcome Minchi Lee to the Marxist School of Sacramento.
Thank you, Seth, for the nice introduction. And, it's a great pleasure to be at the Marxist School of Sacramento. I want to.
Okay. That's great.
Now, I want to start by talking a little bit about the current crisis. Now, if you look at this, because of this computer setup, actually there's one line that is missing, and which says farewell to 1989. And so some of you might know why we are talking about farewell to 1989. 1989, of course, that's the year when the elites of the global capitalist system, its theorists and the apologists all celebrated the so-called end of history. And so now 20 years from 1989, it's a time to reflect upon that. And in this year, of course, the global capitalist economy is right now in its deepest crisis since the World War II. The US economy right now is having its most serious recession after World War II. And later we are going to see in the and how the current recession compares to the earlier economic crisis in the post-World War II period. Let me first just briefly say some of my personal assessment about how this crisis is likely going to turn out. Now, towards the end of this year, and maybe by next year, we may see a sort of some kind of economic recovery. And there may be some kind of stabilization of the economic conditions. But by stabilization, we are not talking about a return to vigorous economic expansion. We are not talking about a return to capitalist prosperity. We are just talking about stabilization. In other words, we are basically talking about economic stagnation. And the basic reason is that the US economy traditionally is led by the expansion of household consumption. But over the past years, the US households, of course, have accumulated excessive level of debt. And so it will take a long period of time for the US households to repair the balance sheet. On the other hand, there's no reason to expect the household real income, especially the working class real wage, to grow in any kind of rapid rate. And so given these kind of circumstances, at best we could hope for some kind of stagnation on the part of US economy, European economy, and maybe similar to how the Japanese economy performed in the 1990s. So that's what's likely to happen in the next 2, 3, 5 years. Then beyond 2015, so after 5, 6 years, we could move into another stage of crisis. I think now there's very strong evidence that the global oil production has passed its peak. That is to say, in the past, the global oil production in general tends to rise from one year after the other. And then after it passes peak, however, although it would still fluctuate, in general it will tend to decline. What happened was that the global oil discovery already peaked back to the 1960s. There's no controversy about that. And oil, of course, is a finite resource. You have to discover it first before you can explore it. So if the global oil discovery peaks several decades ago, it's just a matter of time before the production peak takes place. And among the world's largest oil producers, the US oil production peaked back in 1970. The US used to be the world's largest oil producer, the largest oil exporter, but it peaked in 1970. And then Mexico, which used to be the world's fifth largest oil producer, peaked in 2004. The most important European oil producers like Britain, Norway also peaked. And now there's evidence which suggests the world's first and second largest oil producer, Saudi Arabia, Russia, may have also peaked. Overall, the evidence, I think it has become pretty strong that it's very likely that the world oil production peak has already taken place. And if that is indeed the case, and this decline of world oil production could become apparent by about 2015. So on top of the existing economic crisis, and by about 2015, the US and the global capitalist economy would also be hit by the decline of the world oil production. And on top of that, there would also be the worsening of the fiscal crisis across all the advanced capitalist countries. And so that could significantly increase the risk of a general dollar collapse. Then another major pillar of global capitalist economy, the Chinese economy, I think in the next few years, China should be able to maintain relatively rapid growth. Unless China makes some
continue.
But beyond about 2020, I think China could also face an insurmountable social and energy crisis. And if that happens to China, and that could lead to a general collapse of the global capitalist economy. So from that perspective, the current crisis is only a signal which would suggest the early stage of a prolonged period of major economic and political instability. So what is likely to be the outcome of this multi-decade long major political and economic instability? Okay, so these are the words from Martin Wolf. By the way, I highly recommend the Financial Times. You know, that's the British newspaper. The newspaper for the British bourgeoisie, but it's a very informative paper, and among the bourgeois newspaper, that's one of those honest bourgeois newspaper that attempts to analyze the conditions of global capitalism as honest as possible. And so, unlike the many North American papers like the New York Times, and it does not try to treat the issues in a superficial way. And its coverage about global capitalist crisis, its coverage about climate change, social contradictions, if you read the paper carefully, in many cases, you can get important insights. So in this case, Martin Wolf, that's one of the major columnists of Financial Times. And so this is the published in March 9, 2009, when Financial Times is started to publish a major series on the future of capitalism. Okay, so in other words, the elites of the system now get very concerned about the future of capitalism. So Martin Wolf says that another ideological god has failed the assumptions that root for three decades suddenly look as outdated as revolutionary socialism. Okay. Now, here we have a graph. This graph basically shows the annual growth rate of world economy. Now, economic growth, of course, is by no means a good measure of the quality of life, of people's happiness, but as far as the health of capitalism is concerned, it is indeed a reasonably good indicator. Now the last portion, last black part, and which would represent the predicted estimated economic growth rates by IMF for 2008, 2009, and 2010. And you could see that this year, it's predicted that we are going to have contraction of the global economy by 1.3% a year. The gray curve, that represents the actual economic growth rate that took place from 1950 to 2007. And so you could see that this kind of absolute contraction of global economy has never happened since World War II. Now by 2010, it's predicted that we are going to have some recovery and there would be some positive growth and below 2%. By the past historical standard, that would still be below the threshold for global economic recession. The red curves, those represent the average growth rates in previous periods of major capitalist instability, like during the first half of the 20th century from 1914 to 1945, or from the 1960s to 1980s. The green curve by comparison represents the periods of relative capitalist prosperity. So you have, if you have heard about this before, some economists talk about long waves of capitalist development. So the red curve in this case would represent the downward phases, and while the green curves would represent the expansionary phases. So if we think about if the current crisis is only the early stage of a prolonged period of instability, the question is how this period of instability will compare with the earliest periods of instability. Now, in the past, in the period from 1914 to 1945, and then from 1968 to 1989, the global capitalist system, under different historical circumstances, and were confronted with major crisis, instability. But as a result of the crisis, capitalism managed to restructure itself. A new institutional structure emerged in the period of instability, and so that conditions were recreated for capitalist expansion, for vigorous accumulation. So one question we would like to ask is, given our current period of crisis, what's the possibility for capitalism to again undertake some kind of restructuring, reform, institutional change? And is it possible that towards the end of this instability, we will again see a restructuring of capitalism that would again lead to a new set of conditions that are favorable for capitalist expansion? So to answer these questions, it's useful to first look at what happened in the past and see how in the past capitalism managed to restructure itself. Okay, now, to address these questions, I guess maybe as a starting point, it's useful to think about, you know, what would be required for capitalism to function well? There are a number of things. First of all, capitalism is an economic system based on production for profit. So conditions are favorable for high profit rate, for high rate of return for capital accumulation. And that would be one necessary condition. And secondly, of course, we know that the capitalist system is also one that is based on the exploitation of the working class, and therefore, inevitably, that involves class conflicts. But the one necessary condition for a system based on the class conflicts to function, of course, these class conflicts need to be managed, and it should not get out of control. If it gets out of control, then a system based on class exploitation cannot function. Then thirdly, there's also one unique piece of a feature. Capitalism is a system based on interstate competition, or in other words, it's a system based on nation states. In other words, there is no world government under the capitalist world system. Now, in this kind of system, the system of nation states, on the one hand, it's necessary, or let's say it provides some favorable conditions for capital accumulation. On the other hand, it also causes trouble, because if each nation state only pursues the interests of national capitalists, there's a question about, could this kind of competition be nation states that would in turn destroy the functioning of the entire system? Would that in turn undermine the interests of the entire system? So who is going to taking care of the interests of the entire system? So historically, the kind of solution, or at least let's say something that helped to alleviate the contradiction, is that from time to time there would be one nation state that would tend to become relatively powerful, and this relatively powerful nation state from time to time would act as the hegemonic power in the system. And when you have got the effective hegemonic power, and this hegemonic power, while pursuing its national capitalist interests, would in the meantime to some extent promote or regulate the systemic interest. So that's the way to solve this contradiction. So these are the conditions required for a good capitalist system to function. So what were the historical conditions in the first half of the 20th century? First of all, back to the early 20th century, and instead of the modern kind of capitalism with substantial government management of the macroeconomic conditions, back to the early 20th century, what prevailed was the free market, small government capitalism. And so under that kind of free market, small government capitalism, the condition was that there was a tendency for capitalist economy to become increasingly unstable. There was tendency for the economic fluctuation, for the economic crisis to become more and more violent over time.
1914 to 45?
Right.
You're making that argument for the United States or the whole world?
Everywhere, yeah.
I'm sorry, okay.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think that's pretty well established. So there is a tendency for this capitalist economy to become increasingly unstable, and so that means it's not possible for the capitalists to secure a stable, predictable, high profit rate. Okay. Then secondly, by the early 20th century, new social forces had also emerged in the capitalist world system. And on the one hand, the working classes in the Western capitalist countries had become powerful political force. On the other hand, by the early 20th century, the national liberation movements had also emerged and had become increasingly more powerful in the non-Western world, which primarily represented the interests of new westernized elites, like national bourgeoisie or westernized intellectuals in the non-Western world. And the problem was that the capitalist world system that prevailed in early 20th century was not capable of accommodating the political and social demands of these new social forces. And then moreover, while the British hegemony by then was already in its advanced stage of decline, the American American capitalism was not yet ready or not yet willing to replace the British hegemony. And therefore, there was growing geopolitical chaos and throughout the global capitalist system. So under the interaction of all of these three forces, the capitalist system that prevailed before the 20th century by then basically could no longer function, was falling apart, and therefore there was a systemic crisis which took the form of two world wars and Great Depression. So how did capitalism get out of this crisis? Now, first of all, after Second World War, Germany was defeated, the American hegemony was completely consolidated. Now, under the leadership of American imperialism, global capitalism was restructured. In the advanced capitalist countries, Keynesian macroeconomic policies was introduced and widely adopted. There was a major expansion of the size of government, so small government capitalism was replaced by big government capitalism. Before World War II, the typical size of government as a share of gross domestic product in the Western capitalist countries ranged between 5% of GDP to 10% of GDP. And then after World War II, it typically ranged from about 30%, the typical size in North America, to up to 50%, like in some Western European case. So there was a dramatic increase in the size of government. Then welfare state institutions were introduced in the advanced capitalist countries or in the courses of the world system to accommodate the demands from the Western working classes, and then to accommodate the demands of national liberation movements. After World War II, the American imperialism also pushed for decolonization in the non-Western world, facilitated by some economic development programs, and then to accommodate the socialist states, which to a large extent amounted to a radicalized form of national liberation movements, which basically took the form of global Cold War arranged by the Yalta Agreement, which provided the Soviet Union and the socialist states with the sphere of influence within which they could pursue socialist industrialization. So all of this together would form the so-called Global New Deal. And so how did this New Deal work? Well, initially it worked wonderfully. As a result, under this Global New Deal in the 1950s and 1960s, global capitalism experienced unprecedented rapid economic growth. And even the working classes in this period, especially in Western countries, benefited from rising living standard. Now these days, of course, under the current crisis of capitalism, many among the intellectual left are talking about to have another New Deal. So will another New Deal help us to have to get out of current crisis, maybe to construct another social compromise? To evaluate the prospect of a new deal, which is what many people are talking about these days, I guess it's would be good to first look at what happened to the old New Deal and to understand why the old New Deal failed in the first place. So what happened to the old New Deal? Now, the problem for capitalism of this old New Deal was that, of course, under this global New Deal, there was rapid growth, but after years of rapid growth, after years of high employment, then on top of that, you also have welfare state institutions, and so overall, it created relatively favorable conditions for the working classes. It also created relatively favorable conditions for the national capitalist development in the non-Western world. So you might wonder what's wrong with that. Well, the problem is that we are talking about capitalism. Of course, capitalism is a system based on the production for profit. And for the capitalists to have high profits, the precondition is that the working class bargaining power needs to be sufficiently weak so that the capitalists can have high profits. When you have a set of historical conditions that tend to favor the working class bargaining power, and that tends to increase the working class bargaining power, that means it tends to undermine the profits. And then if you undermine the profits, if you tend to lower the profit rate, then an economic system based on the production for profit cannot work. And so that is what happened to global capitalism in the 1960s. There was a general tendency for the worldwide profit rate to fall after the 1960s. And then in the capitalist system, when the profit rate was falling, the system could not work, could not function well. On the other hand, under this so-called global New Deal, it also tended to increase the general political and the social expectations of the working classes and of the non-Western peoples in general. And so by the 60s, there was this upsurge of the global revolution movement. And I guess many people in this room came from this 1960s generation, probably. And so you probably know this story much better than I do. So there was this upsurge of the global revolution movement. And then in this context, basically the global capitalist class tried to reverse this crisis by undertaking a global counter-offensive against revolution, which started in Chile, and where in 1973, the Chilean socialist government under Allende was overthrown by the fascist coup. And then after Pinochet took over power, he invited several economists trained in University of Chicago, who were the students of Milton Friedman, and at the time these were known as Chicago Boys, and who helped to implement the first monetarist experiment in Chile, and which in addition to killing tens of thousands of people, and also successfully reduced the wage share in the Chilean national income from 40% to 20%, that is half, in just a few years. And then in 1976, there was the counter-revolution coup in China when several radical Maoist leaders were arrested, and which marked the failure of the Chinese Revolution. And then, of course, Thatcher came to power in Britain in 1979, and Reagan came to power in 1980. And so with that, global political initiatives, the global political initiatives passed through the hands of the global capitalist class. Now, once the capitalist class had got the political initiatives, what did they do? The primary task for global capitalist class was how to revived the global profit rate. By the 1970s, 1980s, capitalism was still suffering from falling rate of profit. Okay, so without correcting that, you cannot revive capital accumulation. So you have to raise the profit rate. How to do that? First of all, in the advanced capital countries, it generally took the form of the monetarist policy. Okay, so what was the monetarist policy about in the US? It was undertaken under the Volcker Federal Reserve. Officially, it was an economic policy which tried to repress the inflation by dramatically increasing the interest rate. So that was the official explanation. In effect, it was policy that tries to undermine working class bargaining power by dramatically increasing the level of unemployment and therefore raising the profit rate for the capitalists. And then, but the most of the damaging neoliberal policies took place not in the core, or not in the Western country. It took place in places like Latin America, Eastern Europe, Africa. In the case of Latin America, Eastern Europe, we are talking about semi-periphery of the world system. And so it's in these semi-peripheral countries where the neoliberal policies had the most devastating and economic and social consequences. That took the form of which were known as structural adjustments in Latin America, or shock therapies in Eastern Europe. Now, in addition to that, there was a major component of this global neoliberal project that was often neglected that had to do with this phenomena of the so-called rise of China. I'm focusing on the rise of China, but to some extent, the rise of India was also part of this picture. Now, why was this rise of China important? And with China's incorporation into the global capitalist market, and in the meantime, you also had the massive cheap labor force of China that was also incorporated into global capitalist market. And with that taking place, on the one hand, it's possible for transnational corporations to directly relocate factories, workplaces to China, right? And then in many cases, the transnational corporations or capitalist class in general could use the threat of this relocation to force the Western working classes to accept lower wage or to accept less favorable working conditions. And therefore, China's incorporation has the effect to undermine the bargaining power of the global working classes given China's huge size. So this was an important part of this global neoliberal story. So with all of these components, and by the 1990s, there was a global recovery of the profit rate. And by the late 1990s, the US was experiencing the so-called new economy boom. And then there was the 2001 recession, which was supposed to be relatively mild. And then after 2001 recession, the US economy recovered. And then by then, China had also become a major engine of global economic growth. So over the period from 2003 to 2007, it appeared that the global economy entered into another mini golden age. So it again grew rapidly, and it seems that we are were just at the beginning of a prolonged period of rapid expansion of global economy. Of course, it turned out it ended with the dramatic crisis, which is still taking place. So what happened? Now,
the Jamaica crisis? Which crisis? Which is still taking place?
The existing crisis.
Oh, existing crisis.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Now, of course, this China's incorporation into global capitalist market, as we talked about earlier, was very important for neoliberalism because it undermined the global bargaining power of working class by providing this massive reserve of cheap labor force. While that was good for new liberalism, it also created two major contradictions for global capitalism. Now, one major contradiction is that with this massive cheap labor force, and then you also have China's production that has been expanding very rapidly. All of this is very good, except since we are talking about cheap labor force, so that means the Chinese workers' consumption cannot catch up with the growth of the production, if the Chinese workers' consumption grows at all. So if we have the production that's expanding rapidly, but the workers' consumption is not growing rapidly, to whom you are selling all of this massive production of manufactured goods? So it turns out the solution is that the American households are going to serve as the so-called global consumer of last resort. But then you have another problem, that is the American workers since the 1970s have also suffered from declining real wage, declining living standards. So what do you do about that? And how do we have people consume more while having falling income? Well, of course, the not very magic solution is that to persuade people to take on more and more debt, and promoted by successive asset bubbles. And so, which supposedly has worked wonderfully, but of course it cannot be sustained, yet has not been sustained. And so we are now in our current crisis. So that's one of the major contradictions. Now there is yet another contradiction, that is with China's incorporation and the China's rapid growth, and given China's size, it greatly accelerated the depletion of the global resources and also greatly accelerated the development of global environmental crisis. And so that right now China has already overtaken the US to become the world's largest energy consumer, as well as the largest greenhouse gas emitter. So if you look at this graph, this black curve, and that stands for the US, and you could see that it used to be the largest emitter in the world, and so this graph represents the carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel consumption of the world's largest economy. And generally, the US emissions have been growing, although in recent years it has slowed down. And then by now it has been overtaken by China because of this disconnection between the computer and the projector. So some of colors have become somewhat blurred. So basically this one, that is China. And now it's the world's largest energy consumer and the greenhouse gas emitter. Now, that is Japan. And this is Brazil, Britain, Eurozone, and Russia. So you could see that despite the European Union, which has been talking about leading the global effort against climate change a lot, despite this talk, its trend in recent years has basically been flat. And then the only large economy that has actually seen some substantial reduction of emissions since 1990 turns out to be Russia. And so what happened? Of course, it's because of an industrial collapse of Russia after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Before I came here, I had some email exchange with Daniel about China's power plant construction. And so these days, sometimes you read somewhere that the US is building so many gigawatts of wind electricity, or the European Union is building so many gigawatts of wind electricity. If you compare that with how many power plants, coal-fired power plants China is building, it's nothing. And China is building like 100 coal-fired, 100 gigawatts of coal-fired power plants each year. Which means in every 3 years, China would rebuild the entire U.S. coal-fired power plants. And while the U.S. Each year builds all types of power plants, including natural gas, wind, coal, solar, everything, maybe 20 gigawatts each year, right? So long as, you know, this China is still developing this capitalism based on fossil fuels, and there's very little hope that climate stabilization could be achieved. Now, so come back to the question, what is the likelihood that out of this current crisis we could again see a successful restructuring of global capitalism that could again recreate the conditions for viable capitalist accumulation? Now, many people are comparing the current period with the earlier crisis and thinking about, as we talk about, thinking about the possibility to have another so-called global New Deal. Now, there was the old New Deal, we know, after 1945. So compare the current conditions with the post-1945 world, and what are the differences? And first of all, back to 1945, the U.S. hegemony was at its peak, so it could lead the restructuring of global capitalism. Now the U.S. hegemony is in irreversible decline, and it's no longer capable of regulating the global capitalism for the long-term interests of the system. And on the other hand, no other big power is in the position to replace the U.S. To act as the next hegemonic power. So exactly at the time of global capitalist crisis, it's also deprived of effective leadership. And secondly, back to 1945, we know that after World War II, there was this construction of new global social compromise, which took the form of welfare state in Western countries. It took the form of decolonization for the non-Western ruling elites. And today, however, a social compromise that is simply limited to Western working classes would not be enough. Because in the new liberal era, with the incorporation of China, India, and also you also had the Latin America and Eastern Europe. And in the future, if there is to be a new global social compromise, it will have to address the political demands, social demands, not only from the Western working classes, but also the non-Western working classes. And if the global social compromise that was only limited to the Western working classes was already too expensive for global capitalism back to 1960s. And of course, even today, you still have this from time to time, and there has been the capitalist classes in Western countries have been talking about this so-called entitlement reform, which amounts to effort to undermine some of the historical rights that in the past had been won by the working classes in the area of pensions, social security, healthcare. And so given these kind of circumstances, what's the chance to have a social compromise that would accommodate not only the Western working classes, but also the non-Western working classes? Then thirdly, back to 1945, capitalism still had lots of space to pollute the global environment. There had been resource depletion, but in general, back to 1945, the resources depletion was still at the early stage. But by now, the resources depletion had reached the advanced stage, And then in addition to that, the global ecological system now is literally on the verge of total collapse. So under these kind of circumstances, what's the possibility for capitalism to be successfully restructured? I will just say something. How am I doing on time?
10 minutes.
Okay, right. I will just use the remaining time to say something about the climate change, which is the single most important aspect of the global environmental crisis. Now, basically, now there's a growing consensus that if the global temperature warms up to the point that is 2 degrees Celsius warmer compared to the pre-industrial time, then in addition to many other serious ecological consequences, catastrophes, there's the possibility that we are going to pass several tipping points. That is to say, if we pass these tipping points, we are going to cause so much damage to the ecological system so that the Earth's ocean or forests will start to release greenhouse gases themselves. And so if that happens, the climate change could become beyond human control. If global warming reaches 3 degrees, that would mean the destruction of rainforest and potentially lead to a rise of global sea level by 3 meters. And then, according to James Lovelock, the British scientist.
You mean 25 meters?
25 meters,
oh,
yes. Yeah.
You sound like you said 3 meters.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess just that's the. Right. Yeah. Thank you for the correction. Yeah. 75 feet. Yeah. And if global warming reaches 4 degrees, and according to James Lovelock, pretty much most of the world would no longer be suitable for human inhabitation. So only Canada, Siberia, Antarctica, and maybe suitable for human inhabitation. In that case, we could look at a situation where the human population may be forced to reduce by 90%. So how do we prevent this kind of, what are the atmospheric conditions that correspond to these different level of catastrophes? Now, when we talk about this climate change, there are 3 measures we need to bear in mind. One is the global temperature, the thing we just talked about, right? The global temperature compared to the pre-industrial time. And the other thing is the amount of greenhouse gases that is already in the atmosphere, and which would lead to a certain level of global warming, right? And so that is called atmospheric concentration of greenhouse gases, usually measured by the carbon dioxide equivalent. And then the third thing has to do with emissions. Sometimes we talk about emission. The emission has to do with the amount of greenhouses that we put into the atmosphere each year, right? So now let's talk about the second level. Now, according to the IPCC models, IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. According to IPCC models, if we have the atmospheric concentration of carbon dioxide below 450 parts per million, which is measure of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and then that would roughly correspond to a global warming below 2 degrees. So according to IPCC model, to stay below 2 degrees, you want to stay below 450 ppm. But according to James Hansen, who is an American climate scientist, and he argued that IPCC models actually seriously underestimated how the climate would respond to the greenhouse gases. If you believe in James Hansen to prevent 2 degree warming, you need to keep that below 350 ppm. The reality is that right now we are already at 380 ppm, and moreover growing at a rate of about 2 ppm per year. Now, so I will skip this really technical. I have already saved this on Alan's computer, and then later it's going to be posted on your website, so you are going to get this detailed information. This is about emissions. To achieve the, not to say the James Hansen's goal, if the goal is to achieve the what according to IPCC, that is to stay below 450 ppm, we need to immediately start reducing the emission of greenhouse gases at an annual rate of at least 2% a year from now to 2050. Well, the reality is that since 2000, the global emissions of greenhouse gases have grown at an annual rate of about 3% a year. Now, if you look at this graph, the blue curve tells you the world GDP, the historical world GDP from 1820 until 2007. And then the black curve that tells you the carbon dioxide emissions from 1820 until 2007. You could see that these two things pretty much parallel each other. So the basic story is that so long we have an economic system that is committed to capital accumulation, and then so long as capital things, you have capital accumulation, and of course if you have this endless drive towards capital accumulation, economic growth, and for that to happen you need to have energy. And historically that has taken the form of fossil fuels. And so, not surprisingly, the carbon dioxide emission would parallel the growth of the economy. Now, right now there's this international negotiation that's taking place, which is supposed to prepare for a successor treaty, a new treaty, to replace the Kyoto Protocol. And what is the situation of the current negotiation? The developing countries now have converged towards a position to demand a very deep cut on the part of developed countries, based on understanding that historically most of the greenhouse gases that are already in the atmosphere came from the developed countries. So the developing countries are demanding 40% cut of emissions by developed countries by 2020. The European position is to reduce emissions by 20%, maybe by 2020. The US current position is only to return to the 1990 levels by 2020. Okay, so nowhere to match these two sides of positions. And then, as I said earlier, so long as China is still building 100 gigawatts coal-fired power plants each year, and even if the European Union is actually managed to achieve this 20% reduction, that could be offset by 2 or 3 years of China's economic growth. And given this kind of situation, some time ago, a few weeks ago, the British paper Guardian did a survey among the world scientists. And now it turns out 9 out of 10 climate scientists no longer believe it's politically possible to achieve a goal that will limit the global warming at below 2 degrees Celsius. So to conclude, what is the possibility of the current crisis? One possibility, we are again going to see a successful restructuring of global capitalism. But better not, if that indeed happens, pretty much the collective suicide of humanity would be guaranteed. Alternatively, there must be a new social system that is based on the principle of ecological sustainability, as well as the principle of meeting the global population's basic needs. And that would in turn means that it must not be a system that is based on production for profit. It must not be a system that is committed to capital accumulation and endless income growth. And that would in turn require social control of production, social control of the means of production. And that, of course, could only be achieved by some form of socialism. And so I will stop my talk right here and then open for discussion.